Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UT.
A new constitution puts Tunisia at a crossroads. The president and his supporters say it's the dawn of a new era for the nation. Critics call it a power grab that spells the death of democracy. Which is it? And what is next for the North African country? Also,
we recognize that we are not perfect and we are grappling with issues of racism, discrimination, and xenophobia here in the United States as well. We also recognize that these are global phenomena.
We'll introduce you to the new U.S. Special Envoy for Racial Equity and Justice. Desiree Cormier-Smith says there is work to be done at home and abroad. And no longer unknown, we'll present a VOA documentary about one activist's mission to keep the story of slavery in America alive. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
We're going to talk about it every day, period.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll get to the latest developments in Tunisia in a moment. But first, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov is on a four-nation tour of Africa aimed at boosting Moscow's ties with a continent where governments have largely avoided taking sides over the war in Ukraine. Many African countries import Russian grain and increasingly energy too, but they also buy Ukrainian grain and benefit from Western economic ties. Lavrov kicked off his tour in Egypt, and then it was on to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. He will wrap up his tour in Ethiopia. Well, Africa's also being courted by the West this week, with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, also visiting Egypt and Ethiopia. The Russian Foreign Minister's Africa trip also coincides with one by French President Emmanuel Macron. He is in West Africa touring Cameroon, Benin, and Guinea-Bissau. So what's behind Russia's overtures to African nations? What do Western leaders want in the region? And how are the hosting African countries navigating a conflicting legacy of relations with the West and the former Soviet Union? And joining me now to discuss this is Piwo Kushle Mnyandu. He's a political analyst and a lecturer of African studies at Howard University. Piwo Kushle, thank you so much for joining me. Piwo Kushle, there are so many dynamics at play here. Please help us understand what exactly is behind the Russian foreign minister's visit to these four African countries.
Well, we can have a historical perspective on this. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, Vladimir Putin, present leader of Russia, has always looked at the fall of the Soviet Union as what he calls a catastrophe. And this means that all things like glasnost that took place in Russia or in the Soviet Union, they also took place in Russia's footprint in the world. In other words, there was a reconfiguration of the Russian footprint in the world, including in Africa. So what they saw as a diminution of Russian influence has always led the Russians to have a grievance against the Americans, who are preeminent, and the Chinese later, who are also preeminent. So when we're looking now in the present period at the Russian visit during a time of kind of an invasion of Ukraine and a war going on, this reconfiguration then, these visits as part of that reconfiguration to try and claw back Russian influence from the Chinese and from the Americans.
Now, of course, this is not the Soviet Union anymore that we're talking about. There's the past, and I wonder how much of that is about nostalgia and the future, what will actually result in real action. And Lavrov is certainly hitting the right notes with some of these African leaders talking about expanding the UN Security Council, which came up with during his meeting with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. He reportedly said that they talked about reforming the UN Security Council and the underrepresentation in the Security Council of developing states. Now, we know African leaders have long called for this kind of reform, for the Security Council to be expanded and for more permanent representation, of course, for Africa. Is he just saying what he knows African leaders want him to hear, or does a permanent place for Africa on the Security Council have any chance of actually happening?
Oh, I think both. The Russians know what the African grievances are, and they know, and these grievances are also historical. So history has a way of repeating itself. The same way Russia has grievances vis-a-vis its place in Africa, the Africans as well. So as part of these Russian overtures to the African to African countries, the Russians are quite aware that they are behind the Chinese and we might say even the Americans in influence on the African continent. But they believe that they've earned through years, the decade 1970s, 80s, through that developmental project, they believe that they've earned a right to kind of claw this back. So in this then, this talk of African seats in the Security Council is part of that kind of courting of the African opinion, even though it kind of, some may say it's kind of impractical right now.
Well, talking about courting the African opinion, the skies are, as you may have noticed, quite busy these days with world leaders traveling to places like Africa, of course, and the Middle East. We saw President Joe Biden. He went to Israel and Saudi Arabia. The U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, is visiting Egypt and Ethiopia, and French President Emmanuel Macron, of course, visiting several countries in West Africa. Now, with Macron, Hammer, and Lavrov basically in the same region, how awkward is this? And how awkward is it for the Africans, or do they find this awkward at all?
Well, I think the Africans have gotten used to this awkward situation where U.S. Secretary of State Blinken visit right about the same week or a few weeks with the Chinese foreign minister. The Africans are happy at being courted. The Africans are happy that finally the attention of the world is turning towards their continent. And also, though, this is not new. Again, history repeating itself. During kind of the dichotomous times of the Soviet, Cold War, the Africans played a good game playing the U.S. And the Soviets against one another. And I think a lot of African countries are dusting that old playbook and playing the same game, but new times, with Russia, with China, and the United States, and France, of course, always in the mix. So I think it's an old game, but new players and new times.
Pipo Kushle, what exactly has Lavrov accomplished with this trip? And what do the Africans in the long term get out of it?
Well, that's what I'm asking. This is a great question. Well, this reconfiguration that we've been talking about, well, with this war, it has also, this kind of invasion of Ukraine and the war taking place there, it has reconfigured, as we all well know, the supplies of grain, both from the Russian Federation and from Ukraine. Whereas before, some grain may have come from a sovereign Ukrainian state as exports from Ukraine, we kind of are in a no woman's land here, where they're coming from Donbass or Lugansk, wherever they come from in the Ukraine, may determine who you talk to. So the Africans are well aware of this. They don't want to kind of make mad each one of the sides. They kind of don't know where the ball, whose side the ball is going to kind of fall on, as we've seen in the vote at the United Nations.
Are we going to see more of these kinds of trips, especially by the Russians? Did Lavrov really need to make this visit to Africa?
I think it did, because the Africans, when they kind of implicitly, they kind of were asking for peace to reign and their supplies, and kind of like they wanted respite from the food insecurity that this war has plunged a good part of the African continent, at least the countries that import grain from the Ukraine. And so invariably the blame is falling on the Russians, that but for the invasion, we wouldn't have this insecurity. So part of this is actually putting some band-aid on some very, very serious injuries that have taken place, one might say, on the Russian stature on the continent. But with the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Russia has quite a sizable mining interest in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And as we all know, it's kind of a big power in these on these matters. So Russia does have some ground there to kind of cover and get new markets.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. These are interesting times indeed. Piwakushle Mnyandu, thank you so much for your time. Piwakushle is a political analyst and a lecturer of African studies at Howard University. Well, moving now to Tunisia, where President Kais Saied is pleased and celebrating the outcome of Monday's vote on a new constitutional referendum that will give him expanded, near unchecked powers. Supporters of President Saied are hoping the results of this new referendum will end years of economic and political turmoil. Critics, however, fear the added presidential powers will end the Arab Spring's only democracy. VOA's Lisa Bryant spoke to voters as they headed to the polls in the capital, Tunis, on Monday.
In interview after interview at polling stations like this one, the answer is the same.
I'm voting yes for a better future. We're hoping this vote will bring us a better Tunisia.
Among working and middle-class people here in the Tunis suburb of Ariana, people are voting for change from hard economic times. Even if most haven't read the draft constitution, they're voting for...
I am voting yes because the program of Kais Saied is the best for everyone.
Same sentiments at another Ariana polling station.
It's been total mayhem these last years. We need change for the better. It's now or never.
Tunisian President Kais Saied says this referendum, coming exactly a year after he seized far-reaching powers, gives citizens a say after years of political gridlock and guarantees the country a brighter future. His draft constitution enshrines a strong presidency and sharply weakens judicial and legislative powers. Opposition parties and civil society groups say Saied's charter paves a U-turn back to authoritarian rule, unraveling freedoms and rights won in Tunisia's 2011 revolution.
I'm abstaining. I don't believe in the results of this vote. I won't endorse a procedure that I think is illegal.
This is basically the moment when Tunisian democracy, at least for now, dies. Its democratic transition was not consolidated. It had a lot of flaws. It was very fragile. But Tunisia got farther than any other Arab or Muslim country.
Recent demonstrations against the draft charter were marred by violence.
I'm worried about the way Kais Saied's people and Kais Saied's supporters are behaving towards others who are against the referendum and against Kais Saied. They are talking about that people are not patriots, that people are who are taking money from abroad.
Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Ariana, Tunisia.
Well, with more on what's happening in Tunisia and what's next for the North African country, I'm joined by journalist Lisa Bryant, who just reported that story there. She joins us via Skype from Tunisia. And with me here in studio is Intisar Fakir. She's a senior fellow and director of the North Africa and Sahel program at the Middle East Institute here in Washington. Ladies, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. And Lisa, I'd like you to start us off here, please. The results of the referendum are, of course, now official. Please give us a sense of what do people find most worrying about the contents of this new constitution?
Okay, so, you know, the critics find the most worrying several things. First is the original constitution, well, the original, the one of 2014, set up this mixed parliamentary presidential system. It set up a set of checks and balances, including a judicial, you know, check and balance. The new constitution would give the president, you know, vastly expanded powers, including appointing, you know, judges for this yet to be agreed upon constitutional council, which is like this major constitutional court, which is a very high court, obviously similar to the Supreme Court. That's not never been established. Because of lack of agreement. But so that's one thing, vastly increased presidential powers, reduced legislative ones. It sets up this sort of yet to be, you know, confirmed Council of Regions, which is kind of so far a nebulous body, but it further waters down sort of the legislative check and balance. The critics are also worried about, you know, the fact that the president has vastly expanded powers, and that generally that he could abuse them. And, you know, President Saeed, you know, has the option of, you know, seizing, again, quite a bit of control under, you know, if he declares a kind of national emergency. So there are a set of concerns that not only the opposition parties, but also human rights activists, journalists, and some analysts have. And what's also very interesting is that many people, per my reporting, had not actually read the constitution that they were voting for. So what they were doing is mostly saying, hey, we really like this guy. So there's a series of real concerns among the opposition, and President Saeed says this is not, we're not rolling back freedoms, we're trying to streamline the process.
Intisar, does this victory, and given the fact that turnout was so low, does this reveal President Saeed's weakness or his strengths?
I think for the moment it reveals a win for him. He's been able to essentially put into law everything that he has been doing outside of the constitutional bounds since last year. I mean, he suspended parliament on the 25th of July. Then again, he suspended the constitution. So now he is able to sort of operate within the legal, within the sort of new constitution, which is now the law of the land. So that's on the short term. The long term, of course, he has a lot of challenges that he still needs to overcome, and it's not very clear what kind of plan that he has for the economy, for example, which remains just as problematic, if not more problematic, with the recent challenges that Tunisia has seen that have, you know, affected other parts of the world as well. There's the deal that the IMF is now trying to strike. Is he going to be able to create some sort of consensus? Is the IMF going to require some sort of political consensus around that deal? That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, how is he going to manage all of the laws that are effectively going to put the constitutional into practice? So he still has, this is a win for him undoubtedly, but he still has a long road ahead as he tries to consolidate his rule.
Lisa, you spoke earlier about the opposition's reaction. Now, I guess Americans will tell you today, given the events of recent years, that every election counts. And we saw pretty low turnout this time with this referendum. Why, if the opposition is unhappy with the outcome, did they not galvanize their supporters to show up at the polls and try and make a difference there?
Actually, what's quite interesting is that the turnout, as officially declared, is quite a bit higher than quite a few people had expected, including analysts. They had thought something like a 10% turnout. According to the official results, it's 30%. The opposition is disputing that, saying that the people, the election observers they had, did not see that kind of turnout. So that is under dispute. But they had called for a boycott of this referendum, saying it's too much of an insult to everything that Tunisians fought for during the revolution to even vote on this document. It's such a rollback, according to them, of the fundamental rights and freedoms that Tunisians won in 2011. People did vote. We spoke with, you know, obviously a lot of just everybody we spoke to at the polling stations we went to said they were voting yes, but we also spoke to people after the vote, and there were some people who still went to the polling stations and they voted no, because as you just pointed out, they felt it was their duty to vote anyway, so they went out. And a lot of people just didn't show because they don't care anymore, because their concerns aren't, you know, it's not about freedom or anything else, it's about making ends meet, you know, finding a job, paying for the food that's skyrocketing partly because of the war in Ukraine. So it's a real mix, and it's, you know, too early to really figure out what the breakout is, but there was a mix of reasons why people didn't show up.
Intisar, take us back and tell us, how did Tunisia get here? This was the country that was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, the only democracy to have come out of it. How does it end up being this place with a new constitution pushed through by the president, with reforms that some fear could tip this country back into a dictatorship?
Yeah, it's been a very inspiring process, but it's also been a really, really frustrating process for the population that I think was marked by two key dynamics that you mentioned at the outset. First is just the political division and morass that the country has been living in, and second is the myriad economic challenges. So on the political end, you know, you had the 2014 constitution that essentially created a hybrid system where political parties and political actors were going to play a strong role in shaping policies. And unfortunately, that was at odds with the fact that the country did not really have a strong political party culture. There wasn't really these political parties that were suddenly in charge of parliament didn't really have a lot of good ideas on how to take Tunisia forward. And so the parliament really becomes the site of complete dysfunction over the years. And so that's one thing that's been very frustrating to Tunisians. The second is the economy. Of course, we've heard over the course of the 10 or 12 years of the post-revolution world, the economic situation in Tunisia has really declined significantly. You've got low economic output, you've got high indebtedness, public finances are in a really bad shape. And then, of course, all of that is just compounded by the pandemic, the global pandemic, that really just impacted Tunisia in a very, very significant way. And then add to that, of course, all of the disruptions that followed the pandemic and currently the war in Ukraine and the impact that that's having as well. So all of this led the way for someone like Kais Saied to essentially show up and say, you know what, I'm going to take over and I'm going to change the situation.
And of course, he saw opportunity there. Lisa, what is the mood? I know this is always a very, you know, cliche question, but what is the mood like now? Because we saw protests before the referendum. And of course, this was the scene just about a decade ago of a revolution. What does it feel like in that country at the moment?
It feels sad. And I was actually, I was in Tunis on the 14th of January, the day of the revolution. And, you know, so there's none of the energy and for better or for worse, there's none of the energy that was behind this revolution and this feeling of change. The president's supporters are, of course, happy about it. One of the bigger responses to our questions, reasons why people voted yes for this constitution, is they want to fight what they perceive as corruption and also gridlock, as we just, as your Middle East analysts talked about. But the mood is among the opposition, it's somewhat combative. I mean, we spoke to the head of the main opposition, El Nahda party, and a very secular opposition party that are unlikely, they used to be big foes, now they've sort of teamed up in opposition to the president. And they see this, or they carve this out as a fight for freedom, fight for democracy. That's how they're claiming it. So I think there's, at least among the opposition, the sense of we're going to galvanize and get back. But among ordinary people, some people are just don't care and they're just getting through their lives. Obviously, the activists are very disappointed. The opposition says it's going to, you know, get together and galvanize and respond. But there's none of the energy that we saw during the revolution. And it's because, again, people have had years of they just haven't seen the fruits. They put out the effort to protest and get on the streets, and they're not seeing any of the fruits. So it's unclear whether they will have that energy to get back on the streets again if they are unhappy with the outcome.
Intisar, tell us a little bit about Saied, the man himself. How and why has he been consolidating power in recent years?
So he is, you know, he's a sort of a bit of an odd man without really much charisma, but he kind of happened to be there at the right moment. And he, you know, he adopts all of the tropes, all of the populist tropes, right? You know, he is accountable to the great Tunisian people. He alone has an idea of how to fix the country. His enemies are the press, the elite, the business elite, so on and so forth. So he has that going for him. But if you look at his support, there's been, to the extent that I've seen polls coming out of Tunisia, there's been decline in the number of people that have supported him from the moment that he essentially suspended parliament last year. to now, to the eve of the Constitution. And I think that also fits in with the voter turnout. If you look at the referendum as essentially a vote on the man and his vision, it's 30%. As Lisa mentioned, this is still debated by the opposition. But even at 30%, this is not a large part of the population.
Lisa, give us a little bit of an idea of who President Saied's supporters are, and why would they go and vote yes for a constitution that could expand his powers? What is the logic for them with their yes vote?
I don't know if there's been a study really breaking it down, but a lot of the people we saw were people who were working class. And a lot of the people we saw were maybe 30 and over. We didn't see a lot of young people. And they were in the coffee shops or they were among the opposition. So what we saw, at least, was, you know, somewhat of an educational divide, or also just, the activists being younger people, et cetera. Also older, you know, we've met some, you know, old-time, you know, protesters from the Ben Ali era. So we saw people who are working class, who have been struggling, who have been on the front lines of the economic freefall, you know, with the drop in tourism because of COVID or because of the terrorist attacks from, you know, quite a few years ago, whatever. So these were sort of more working class people, people who were angry at sort of the political and, you know, economic elite, who wanted to take it back. Why are they doing this? They don't see this as a rollback of power. They see this as an honest guy, a corrupt-free guy, maybe not the most charismatic guy in the world, but he's coming into power. He promises to fight for the little guy. His vision of a democracy is really a democracy of the sort of the masses. To cut through parliament, to cut through, you know, journalists, you know, and civil society and get straight to the people. So this is their revolution. So they see somebody, and as you noted, and as your expert noted, you know, eroding support, but they see this as a man who can deliver for them. And one interesting thing is that I said, well, what if, you know, what if he does it? What if he becomes a dictator? And a few of them said, hey, we'll just take that. You know, we'll be back on the street. We'll just kick him out. But again, I'm not sure about that energy level of doing that.
Intisar, as we've been discussing, Saied has a plethora of challenges. We mentioned terrorism, high unemployment, corruption, and of course, an economic crisis. What is he telling people? Because I always find it interesting when it's one thing to make promises when you're trying to get into office. I'm always quite fascinated by leaders who are in office and are still making promises that they will do something. What is he going to do now that he wasn't or didn't do before?
It's very unclear. You know, he doesn't really have much of an economic track record to speak of. His vision for the economy was was very much based on this sort of anti-corruption plan, where he says he's going to try to bring back the money that was embezzled out of Tunisia during the Ben Ali era. Now, you know, how do you do that? Is that sufficient to actually reshape an entire country's economy? No. But, you know, he has been able to do a couple of things that have played well with the masses. Like, he leaned on some vendors during the month of Ramadan to offer some discounts, to lower the prices a little bit. This is not sustainable. But again, it goes back to this sort of paternalistic kind of approach that he has that I think appeals to some of the Tunisians. But he doesn't really have much of an economic plan. The advisors that surround him, there doesn't seem to be anyone there with any kind of economic competence. And then, you know, it also sort of, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with the IMF deal, which Tunisia really needs right now to get some of the financial resources that they need. But in terms of the country's fiscal challenges, they're still in a mess. He doesn't really have a big plan for that. And more importantly, he doesn't really seem to prioritize the economy all that much. So we'll see.
Lisa, what's the sense in the country around whether this now indeed does spell the death of the Arab Spring? You were there when it happened. You're there now. Do you think that, or what are people telling you? Do you think that the Arab Spring ultimately and fundamentally made changes in that country or in the region that they can point to at this point?
I think there are some people who think that this is the end of the Arab Spring, at least for now. That was the response of at least a couple of the experts we spoke to and some other people on the street, that it could take, you know, as Intisar was talking about, it will take a while for, let's say, I mean, maybe the president will do a great job, and maybe he will, you know, really, this constitution will work and it will streamline all the gridlock that has been there. But if that's not the case, and there's going to be this disenchantment and anger, will that translate into another Arab Spring? Or maybe after, you know, President Saeed, the next person could be a dictator or could use this constitution that offers a lot more of an ability, according to experts, to be a dictator, and that could trigger something else even worse. So there's this period, this sense of uncertainty and depression among quite a lot of people. Again, some of the people that we talked to said, look, we've kicked them out before. Tunisians learned how to speak out. They couldn't do this before. I mean, I had seen it before during the Ben Ali period, that people were too afraid to talk to me as a journalist. Now they know how to speak. They know how to get on the road, the street. They're too tired now. But I think it would be extremely difficult to silence them today.
Very, very briefly, Intisar, we've got very little time. Is this the death of the Arab Spring, yes or no?
It's a big blow for sure, but I am hopeful. I think, as Lisa mentioned, the past 10 years, which unfortunately are often tainted by the socioeconomic challenges, really fundamentally changed society. There is a young generation of Tunisians that don't remember what Ben Ali era was like, and that's going to be very hard to change. Qais Saeed's new constitution would notwithstanding.
Well, this is certainly a very, very interesting. These are interesting developments. Ladies, I do appreciate your insight. I'll thank you to you, Intisar Fakir from the Middle East Institute, and VOA's correspondent Lisa Bryant joining us from Tunis in Tunisia. Thanks. Ladies, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, coming up after the break, my interview with the U.S. government's special envoy for racial equity and justice, and why she says the work that lies ahead of her is so important. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. She's the U.S. government's first ever special representative for racial equity and justice. Desiree Cormier-Smith was appointed in June this year and says she wants to tackle issues like discrimination, xenophobia, inequality and social justice, both here in the United States and abroad. Well, I sat down with Cormier-Smith at the U.S. State Department here in Washington recently, and in her first television interview since taking on this new role, she spoke to me about what she hopes to accomplish. So you are the U.S. Special Representative for Racial Equity and Justice. This is a new position created by the Biden-Harris administration, and you are the first person in this role.
I am.
Tell us a little bit about why this role was created and what does your new job entail?
Great question. Glad we're starting there. So the creation of this role is a continuation of the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to advancing human rights and centering human rights in our foreign policies. It is an acknowledgement that the unfortunate reality is that for members of marginalized racial and ethnic communities, the basic premise outlined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights,
is an aspiration but not a reality. So the creation of my position is to really acknowledge that we need to center equity in our work. And I have the honor of joining a roster of an ambassador for religious freedom, ambassador to combat anti-Semitism, an ambassador for global women's issues, a special envoy for LGBTQI plus rights, and a special advisor for disability rights to ensure that we are advancing a foreign policy that really centers equity and working towards a world in which all human beings are free and are able to live up to their full potential.
Tell us a little bit more about you, and tell us about your background and what has prepared you for this role.
Sure. Well, so I'm from L.A., Los Angeles, more specifically Inglewood, California, which until recently, you know, whenever people heard about Inglewood or saw it in movies or television shows, it was always a negative thing, right? Lots of connotation about gangs and drugs and violence. But that's not the Inglewood I experienced. My family came to Inglewood from Louisiana, and I was raised by my grandparents with my mom as well. And my grandfather was a well-known civil rights activist. So I can say that this is sort of in my blood, sort of fighting for social justice and equality for all people. I started my career in foreign affairs. I received a fellowship when I was in college to join the Foreign Service. And so I began my career as a Foreign Service officer. I did tours in Mexico, in South Africa, as well as here in Washington, D.C. And that enabled me a really intimate understanding of how the State Department works and how we engage in the world. I then worked in the private sector, working with major foundations and companies and startups interested in investing in countries across Southern and East Africa. And I helped them do that in a manner that created sustainable and real benefit for the local communities in which they were investing. Then I joined civil society, and I advocated for more just, humane, and equitable foreign policies towards Africa, towards Europe and Eurasia, and was beginning to build out a global work, a global platform to combat global anti-Black racism. Then I was honored to come back home to the State Department in 2021, where I served as a senior advisor in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs, where I led our work to advance racial justice issues multilaterally.
You spoke earlier about the place that you're from and how there are all these negative perceptions about that. I think that is one thing that Africans can relate to, how a place and its people can be framed or portrayed in a way that affects the way people are seen and perceived. And, you know, America itself is often praised and criticized for having strings attached to its foreign aid, especially when it comes to, you know, its diplomatic engagement with countries that they have to improve their human rights record. Is the work that you're going to be doing going to affect a country's relationship with the United States?
Well, let me start by saying this. We recognize that we are not perfect, and we are grappling with issues of racism, discrimination, and xenophobia here in the United States as well. So we start from a perspective of humility, but we also recognize that these are global phenomena, right? And so we have to start with our own work and how we are engaging with these communities in the countries. So let me be crystal clear that my job is not to admonish or lecture other governments on how they are treating marginalized racial and ethnic communities. We are starting this work by taking a critical assessment of our own policies, our own programs, and our own engagements, and how they are either supporting and uplifting marginalized racial or ethnic communities in each country, or if facing the hard truth and acknowledging where we are falling short in addressing their marginalization. So we're starting with ourselves. And that's critically important because, as President Biden said, we are most effective when we lead not by the example of our power, but by the power of our example.
But I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, often when we talk about these issues, coming from an American, people might think that your work is going to be focused almost exclusively on domestic matters. How do you see racial equity and justice figure into America's foreign policy? What's been missing, in your view, from the global conversation?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We have seen how every major crisis that we are facing today, whether it be COVID-19, climate change, food insecurity, democratic backsliding, has a disproportionate impact on members of marginalized racial and ethnic communities. When we fail to acknowledge that, our policies are not going to be as effective or enduring. So when we apply that lens to our work, as Secretary Blinken has said, we know that embedding equity across our foreign affairs work will increase the visibility of racial and other inequities and will lead to better informed foreign policies that will reduce the barriers to equality worldwide.
If you look at sort of our audience on the African continent, what are the issues and the specifics of those issues that you'd like the State Department and what you will be focusing on through your work, what are the issues that are closest to your heart and that you think deserve the greatest attention right now?
That's a really hard question. Two things are going to be critical in this work and that are very important that I clarify early on. First, this work is not about me being a quote-unquote voice for the voiceless. It really is about listening to and centering members of marginalized racial and ethnic communities in our policies. These communities know better than anyone the challenges they face, and they also know better than anyone what they need to overcome these challenges. But for far too long, they have simply been excluded from the rooms where the decisions are being made that impact them. And this is especially true for Indigenous communities. And I want to be clear that my portfolio does include Indigenous communities and other marginalized ethnic groups around the world. Secondly, this is not about me applying an American lens to the problem. We cannot apply a one-size-fits-all approach. Because while we know that racism, xenophobia, and discrimination are global phenomenon, they are manifested in unique and distinct ways in every single country around the world. So that's why it's critical that we start by listening to the members of these communities, and then I also will be planning to sit down with all of my colleagues across the Department of State in each regional bureau to have an honest conversation about how these challenges are manifested in their regions and in their countries. And that's how we start, because we cannot take a one-size-fits-all to this approach. It will be completely ineffective, and I think will look quite silly, frankly.
Well, is some of your job going to focus on the relationship between the U.S. and African countries, between what goes on internally in African countries or what goes on between African countries, or all of the above?
That's a really interesting question. My mandate is to promote and advance the human rights of members of marginalized racial and ethnic communities. My goal is to also combat systemic racism, discrimination, and xenophobia wherever it exists. So wherever that is true in a country or in a region, that's where we will focus.
If we come back to you in, let's say, a couple of years' time, what would you hope to have accomplished or fundamentally changed in this job and in this relationship between the United States and African countries?
That is such a hard question, because this work is not easy. We're dealing with issues and challenges that have been baked into systems and institutions for centuries. So it's not going to be flipping a light switch. It really is, as Secretary Blinken likes to describe it, more like turning an aircraft. So I have to sort of manage my own expectations that this work is going to be, we have to be engaged in it for the long haul, and we are not going to see sort of immediate shifts, right? But as long as we're working towards progress, that's all I can ask. And in 5 years or a couple years, if you come back, I would like to report to you that we have effectively embedded a racial and ethnic equity lens into all of our work. What does that mean? It means the way that we do for gender. So let me give you an example. When we're talking about climate change, when we're talking about COVID-19, there is, I think, a broad acknowledgement now across the State Department and across the federal government that women and girls are impacted differently and disproportionately. I want us to look at all those same challenges and say, yes, women and girls are impacted differently, but there's also a different and disproportionate impact on members of marginalized and ethnic communities. How can we support them? How does our response need to be differentiated based on their specific and disproportionate impact and need?
Desiree Cormier-Smith, congratulations. Hopefully this isn't our first and last conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Desiree Cormier-Smith there. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll bring you a VOA documentary called No Longer Unknown, and we'll tell you why this activist has made it her mission to keep the story of slavery in America alive. That's next. Back in a moment.
Empowerment and humanity towards a better world.
Economic and social progress of every society.
Facts and information from key players rather than spectators in politics, business, science and technology.
City, rural, educated or underprivileged. We care and we listen to what matters to you.
Your voices are our voices.
Welcome back. The American city of Louisville, Kentucky, has a long history of slavery, segregation, and racism. Poet and activist Hannah Drake is using her writing to explore that history in her hometown. Following the wrongful police killing of Breonna Taylor, a young black woman living in Louisville, Hannah has been reflecting on what freedom and equality look like for black Americans today. Now she's using her art as activism to ensure the history of slavery and its impact on American society is not forgotten. Here is VOA's documentary, No Longer Unknown.
When I was three, my mom taught me how to read. I could immediately pick up on words. In my head, I can see exactly where the words should go. It's like rearranging a puzzle. I just can see the whole picture, but I just see it with words. I never wrote poetry like love poems or about nature, always about race for some reason. It was always about this struggle of being black, and it was about wanting freedom. The bulk of my work was just looking at the world around me and saying, I have something to say about this. The Ohio River is a dividing line between Indiana and Kentucky. So Indiana was a free state. Kentucky was a slave state. Louisville is a very divided city. It has a lot of challenges, yeah. And most of them, to me, are centered around racism. When people are done being racist, I'll never talk about racism again. Until that, we're going to talk about it every day, period.
Thank you, Hannah.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union. But as I look around this nation, I have to ask myself, what are we doing? How many more times must I continue to sing the same song? Somebody tell me, how is it that we continue to get this wrong? How is it that after 400 years, we are still trying to whitewash history? How is it?
Hi, Mr. Hamilton. How are you?
I'm good. How about you, sweetheart?
I am well. I was speaking at your bell, so I'm sorry I'm late. My shoes off?
Yeah, take your
shoes off. Okay.
Let's see. That's what we're going to do. Let me get some warm water.
Ready?
I'm ready.
My mom, when she was a little girl, she used to pick cotton in Tennessee. So I asked, what was your grandmother's name? She said, I don't know her name. That's like the end of me tracing my family anywhere. Kentucky lynched 169 people that they know of. 8 of them are listed as unknown. And for some reason, it just, that word stayed with me, which is why I think my life's work in discovering these names are important to me. I think it was a path I was always on. The Unknown Project is on the Ohio River, and it's on a platform. And in this platform are footprints. And I wanted people to be able to sit and just look across the Ohio River and see how close freedom really was. So on the backs of these benches are the names of people that were enslaved. We want to mark where we believe, or history believes, the narrowest part of the river that enslaved people would have crossed. For Black people in America, it always seems like it's just right there in front of you. And if I can just get to this thing, then I will be free. There is nowhere you can go that slavery has not touched in America. It's the story of America. It built America. Black people in America want to be free. Yeah. We're not free when you can come in my home and kill me. That's not freedom.
Overnight, cries of justice for Breonna Taylor only growing louder. These intense scenes unfolding across the country just days after a grand jury ruled not to charge the Louisville police officers involved in her death.
Every day was like a war zone. You could not have kept me from downtown. Not when a Black 26-year-old woman is murdered in her home by the police. I have to use what I know to do, which was to speak and to use my voice and to use poetry.
That is why I'm in these spaces. It is for everyone that came before me, that sipped water at the colored-only fountain, that marched into integrated schools and knew they would be just one of nine. It is for my mother, that stood in the space of a cotton field picking cotton for 80 cents a day. It is for everyone that will come after me, for them to know that they have a right to be in these spaces, to have a seat at the table, in these spaces, to have a voice, in these spaces, to have influence, in these spaces. You see, that is why I stand in these spaces, even when it makes me uncomfortable. And now some of you sit looking at me, and now you feel uncomfortable. But today you have heard me.
And then remember the first night, second night of the protest, when we went out?
We went out the third night.
No, we went out the second night.
Lord Jesus, it all seems like it's not real. Here we are. That's May 29th.
Look, black t-shirt.
Black t-shirt, justice for Breonna. We was ready, wasn't we? And this is when all hell broke loose. Right before we got tear gas.
I was in the grass.
This armored truck, and we were telling these people, get up. Don't sit in front of this truck. And it looks like you have on a no-no.
No, this was when we thought we were going to reconcile things 2 days after being tear gassed.
Lord, keep me near the cross.
That was such a crazy time.
It doesn't seem real. It doesn't.
And I wish it wasn't.
Yeah. And it keeps on, you know, Trayvon, it's, yeah. I wish it wasn't either, I do. Oh, this was, my friend did this video. This is Formation.
When you sip from Mother Earth, you're drinking all our nation. This is lyrical liberation. You want to be mad at something? Be mad at the blood on the hands of this nation.
That's crazy.
Well, look at him.
Pick him come up, Bree.
I knew that it was you. Hi, babe. Oh, thank you.
My daughter is named Brianna, and she's 26 years old. Same age as Breonna Taylor when she was killed. I don't want that to happen to my daughter. And I don't want my daughter to live in a space where at times you can just feel the racism. You know, I want my daughter to have an opportunity to live free. That's why I do many of the things that I do. But yeah, they want the same footprints to come mm-hmm. out of the water.
Do you kind of know, I can envision 8 to 10 feet. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, or 12, mm-hmm. whatever. How long it takes to get to a certain point. Okay. All right. Yeah, we're going to have to revisit the foundry on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just kind of, you know, wiggle it around like you're trying to get it loosened up, see? And then try to just lift your foot up and pull it. Yeah, there you go. Oh, that's it. Go ahead. Go ahead. Easy now. You want it'll split, but that's okay because it's thin right in there anyway, okay? That doesn't matter. So now just try to lift your foot out and wiggle your toes. Keep wiggling your toes. And look at that. Oh, shit. That's perfect. Perfect.
I can see my toes.
Look at your skin. You see that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, next step is just to pour some plaster into that and get a reproduction of it. And then that, voila, that's it.
That is something else.
Here, it takes time.
I got time. Whenever you call me, I'm going to run over right. and get it. I love you.
Love you, baby. Take care. Be blessed.
You too.
No one knew Breonna Taylor. And then, like I said, the camera shifted to Louisville, and everyone wanted to, who was that girl? She had a name. What was her name? Her name was just Barry. Same thing with the Unknown Project. These people are no longer unknown. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sets of feet. To go from here to that edge, I think. Let me do it again. That's perfect. These are my daughter's footprints. She's the unknown. These are my daughter's. Yeah. Am I your descendant? I stare at my face and wonder if I look like you. When I quiet myself, I can hear you. Your voice carries on the wind. It sounds like echoes floating in the distant breeze. I try to put faces to shadows. I search for you in cotton fields and scattered bones, unmarked graves, and watery tombs that attempt to erase you from history, but you were here. You existed. I found your name. It was almost hidden, but in finding you, I found me.
VOA's documentary, No Longer Unknown, a powerful story indeed. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you so much to my guests for joining me. And thank you to our affiliate stations airing the show across the African continent. And thank you to you for joining me on television, radio, and online. Thank you for watching, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.
Let's go.